Okay, so we're talking about geology of the terrestrial planets last time, and kind of the main upshot is this is, of course, Earth, and we see nothing like this. We're never going to see anything like this. And in some sense, that's kind of a big puzzle, particularly in the case of Venus, because Venus seems to be a planet that has pretty similar to the Earth. It's got similar density, similar size. It's closer to the Sun, but you wouldn't think that would affect the geology very much. So it's a kind of a major puzzle in planetary geology why we don't see plate tectonics on Venus. So what we do see is a planet that has relatively small relief. That is to say, there are big areas, most of the planet, where all of the terrain is within 500 meters of what you might call sea level. So there are these big rolling plains that cover most of the planet. And we've had, Russians have had a couple or three landers, and the pictures they show look like bare flood basalts. So if you're going to guess what these things are, you'd guess that they're flood basalts. Maybe it's worth commenting, and we'll talk more about this today. We don't have pictures. This is all radar mapping of Venus. We can't see the surface through the clouds, and the surface conditions are terrible, so landers don't survive for more than a couple of hours. So we have pretty limited information about what's going on. There are a handful of highlands, and they're kind of exaggerated on this globe. We've got Ishkar, which has the biggest volcano, Olympus Mons. There's Beta there, and there's Aphrodite here. So those are kind of continental size highlands, which seem to be volcanic. As I say, there's no magnetic field. One guesses that the inside of Venus should be pretty similar to the Earth. The one exception that might be different, have some reason to think, or at least could easily be different, is the existence of that inner solid core. That's pretty marginal for the case of the Earth. And if you just change the temperatures a little bit, make it a little bit hotter, then it's possible that the inner solid core would disappear. In any case, no magnetic field. Presumably, there's got to be an iron core on the inside. But maybe the very slow and backward rotation rate is not allowing a magnetic field to exist. How old are those surfaces? They're not very cratered. So they're relatively young, certainly younger than the lunar mare. It's hard to date them more accurately than that. Our book likes half a billion years. They may well be younger even than that. There are some hints that there are active volcanoes on Venus. Early spacecraft went by, saw a large and declining amount of sulfur dioxide, and so one interpretation of that data was that there was a volcanic eruption which produced a lot of sulfur dioxide, and then, you know, over time it, I'll use the word rained out, but there isn't any rain on Venus. It was removed from the atmosphere over time. The radar reflection, and that's really all we have from the surface, are indicative of very young surfaces. They're similar to what we see from recent lava that's deposited, say, in the Hawaiis. So there may well be active volcanoes currently, and it may be that this large region that is flood basalts is relatively recently resurfaced, but relatively recently probably can't mean any more recent than, say, 100 million years. So 100 million years, 500 million years, something like that for the big features of the planet. Okay. So the explanations I like, no one knows, right? So these are all speculations, probably wrong. But the explanations I kind of like best for the absence of plate tectonics hinge on two differences between Venus and Earth. First of all, Venus, as we'll learn today, is a very hot planet. It has a very high surface temperature, not so much because it's close to the Sun, but because it has a huge blanket, a huge carbon dioxide atmosphere that's surrounding it. So the surface of the planet starts out like 500 degrees hotter than the surface of the Earth, and so the rocks are going to be more buoyant, right? High temperature things have low densities, and so maybe they're unsinkable. The other characteristic is that even accounting for the high temperatures, Venus is unusually dry. And it turns out that dry rocks are kind of stickier, less viscous than wet rocks, and so maybe we don't kind of have the lubrication that's required for plates to slide by each other. But one way or the other, one plate, no linear mountain ranges, no rift valleys, shield volcanoes, looks like flood basalts, doesn't look anything like the Earth. If we're looking kind of for a major distinction between the planets, kind of just based on something, if we look at the small things, and I'm counting the moon here as a terrestrial planet, even though it's not, if we look at the small things, they're geologically dead. Things are dating from billions of years ago. And because they've been around for a billion years, they're highly cratered. They have flood basalts. But we don't want to put Mercury and the moon too much in the same bailiwick, because the moon is certainly different from Mercury in terms of its density. So of these planets that we've been talking about, the moon has the lowest density, more like crustal rock, and Mercury, technically speaking, has a lower density than the Earth, but that's because it's not as compressed as the Earth is. So if we took Mercury and spread it out on a plate, it would have a higher density than the Earth has. It's got a larger concentration of I don't know what I did with those transparencies. It has a higher concentration of iron, a bigger iron core than the Earth has. Right, so, and actually the recent data, I think this diagram is like 5 years old. The most recent data that came out in the last month actually indicates that the iron core is even bigger for Mercury than we thought 5 years ago. Okay, so here in this picture of Venus, we're guessing a pretty thin lithosphere. Start with a high temperature, you're going to reach the plastic point sooner. And maybe this, what our book calls a light and flaky crust, is partially responsible for the planetary-wide overscale. So Mars has a lower density than either everything except. So the moon has a lower density than Mars, but other than that, Mars is going to be second from the bottom in terms of density. So presumably it has a smaller iron core. The fact that Mars looks red is indicative that there's iron on the surface. So maybe Mars is less differentiated. That is to say, maybe less of the iron that's making up the planet went into the core, and we have more on the surface. In any case, it has a lower density, so it has a lower concentration of iron that's making it up. If we look at Mars, it has the same situation that the moon has. It's not isotropic. The northern hemisphere is very different from the southern hemisphere. And you remember, for the moon, the near hemisphere was different from the other hemisphere. Again, that's not true of Venus, which seems to be pretty much the same all over. So the interpretation here, again, this is a false color map where color indicates elevation, doesn't indicate actual color. The planet is red. Generally speaking, we have highly cratered highlands, which are probably 4 billion plus years old, and we have these lowlands, which show evidences that, I don't know, they might have been ocean bottoms, or at least they had to be wet. So we have outflow channels that sure look like rivers with streamlined craters where material has accumulated in that sort of pattern that are flowing into this region. Now, we want to distinguish between these dendritic channels and the Valley Marineris, which is this huge canyon that's bigger than Grand Canyon. You can see it's a good fraction of the size of the planet. That's not a river sort of situation. It looks like it's a rift valley where the crust has been kind of pulled apart to make this huge channel. It does kind of end in the same ocean bottom sort of region, but it's almost certainly associated with the Tarsus Bulge, where we have these huge tectonic forces that have produced these shield volcanoes, including the biggest volcano in the solar system, Olympus Mons, maybe twice as high as the volcanoes that are on Earth. And presumably, the height of that volcano is indicative of the thickness of the crust, right? So it's kind of like an iceberg. If there's a lot above the surface, then there's even more below the surface. So it's probably indicative of a very thick crust, which goes along with being a relatively small planet. It's going to have cooled off faster, so the crust will have solidified to a greater extent. We got those splash craters, I guess I mentioned, shield volcanoes. We have polar caps that are a combination of water and carbon dioxide ices. Valle Marineris is a rift valley. No magnetic field, even though it has basically the same spin as the Earth. So something is different about its core compared to the Earth. You can see in this diagram, the speculation is that it had a smaller iron core. We got sand dunes, we got sedimentary rocks, which is more indication of water. Certainly way more geologically active than the Moon and Mercury. No plate tectonics whatsoever there, though. So there's kind of a gradation. It looks like size is a determining feature. We got geologically dead objects that are small embers that have cooled off. We've got more geologically active things like the Earth and Venus, which are bigger. It would make a more consistent picture if the Earth wasn't in it, because the Earth has this very specialized plate tectonics, very, very, very active plate tectonics. Questions about geology? So you might think that this is the end of geology, right? Because what's coming up next is to talk about the gas giant planets. They don't have surfaces, so they don't have geology. But it turns out that the moons of those giant planets have very interesting geologies. So we'll come back and totally different from the geology of these things that we've been talking about. So we'll come back and talk about geology again when we talk about the big moons. So the plan today is to talk about atmospheres of the terrestrial planets. And I thought it would be smart to remind you of what we talked about a couple of times ago about how atmospheres work. So on Earth, we talked about geostrophic balance, and we had this kind of picture where we had the winds that are blowing around the high and low pressure systems, where we have the Coriolis force that is balancing the pressure force. So this is, I think, a northern hemisphere view. So here we have high pressure, here we have low pressure. So there's a pressure force that's pushing this way. It's being balanced by a Coriolis force, because the air is moving this way, so when it's pushed to the right, the Coriolis force to the right is going to balance the pressure forces to the left. So big pressure gradients require big winds like we've been having recently. And kind of an overall scale, we had atmospheric layers. We had the troposphere down here at the surface, the stratosphere, and the funny thing is, as we went up in the Earth's atmosphere, it got colder and colder and colder, and then between the troposphere and the stratosphere, it's called tropopause, the temperatures got warmer, then they got colder, then they got warmer again. We had jet streams. So particularly in the winter hemisphere, there is a strong jet stream, strong winds that are blowing from west to east, not particularly at the surface, but up high. And we explain those as being a consequence of the thermal winds. Right? So the thermal winds was the phenomena that horizontal temperature differences result in pressure differences at altitude. And pressure differences through geostrophic balance are going to give you the corresponding wind speeds. Right? So this was kind of the picture that we had. So cold air, more dense air, so the pressure goes down faster. Warm air is low density air, so the pressure goes down not so fast. So we end up with high pressure air at the same altitude compared to the colder air. And again, pressure differences are balanced by Coriolis forces, and that leads to this high speed air. In both the northern and the southern hemisphere, these are winds that are blowing from west to east because the Coriolis force is reversed in the southern hemisphere, and which way is cold is reversed in the southern hemisphere. So we have a double reversal, which leads to the same westward flowing air in the hemisphere. More subtle are the Hadley circulation. So generally speaking, the planet is going to be heated in the equator, and we need to transport that heat to the pole. And so we have horizontal convection that's part of these Hadley cells. In the case of the Earth, it's not particularly obvious. You're not going to see it in, if you take a picture of the Earth, there's nothing that's going to show you this this phenomena. But if you look at averaged phenomena, what you see here is the blue indicates rising air, the red indicates falling air. So there's a convection cell here that's between the equators and say 30 degrees. And there's another, it's a little bit weaker convection cell. So here we have falling air and here we have rising air. So we have three of these convection cells that go from the equator to the pole, and of course another three that are in the southern hemisphere. So very roughly speaking, you know, this is going to show the difference between the Earth and Venus, but very roughly speaking, here we have three, and they're not as organized as our book shows three, but it's not really that simple. That's maybe kind of the average situation. We've got a very strong convection cell here, a horizontal convection cell, Hadley cell, here near the equator, and less and less obvious Hadley cells as we work our way up. Okay, so we got layers, we got Hadley cells, we got the thermal wind, we got geostrophic balance. The other thing we had is this temperature difference. So long ago, we had a formula for the temperature of a rock based on its distance from the sun, its albedo, the temperature of the sun, the radius of the sun. But the temperature of the surface of a rock is not the temperature of a surface of the planet. Many planets have atmospheres, and so they have a blanket on them. So what we're interested is the relationship then between the temperature that we can calculate, the temperature at the top of the atmosphere, and the temperature deep down inside the atmosphere. So this goes under the name of the greenhouse effect. And basically the idea is that somehow or other, energy is being deposited by the sun on the surface of the planet, and that energy has to work its way out before it reaches the top of the atmosphere where it can escape. And in some sense, the thicker the blanket, the bigger the temperature difference is going to be between the top and the bottom of that atmosphere. So if the atmosphere were using conduction, which it's not, you can think about this kind of like your house. You buy R factor insulation, and the temperature difference between the inside and your outside house divided by your R factor tells you the heat flow, how much money you have to pay NSP in order to heat your house. So if we kind of reverse that around, the better the heat flow for us is specified not by what we pay NSP, but what the sun is doing. So the heat flow that's produced by the sun times this R factor is going to give us the temperature difference between the top and the bottom of the Earth's atmosphere. Well, that's not how it works, because conduction is not the principal way energy is transferred in any planetary atmosphere. It's usually some combination of adiabatic, which is to say convection heat transfer, and radiative heat transfer. But it works the same way in either case. In the case of convection, there's what's called the adiabatic lapse rate. That's how the temperature has to change with altitude in order to cause these convection cells. And roughly speaking, it depends on the mass of the atoms in the atmosphere, the acceleration of gravity, this constant that's called Boltzmann constant. And roughly speaking, for the Earth, it's about 10 degrees Celsius per kilometer. So for every kilometer the atmosphere is thick, it's an extra 10 degrees that we need to have down at the surface. Another way of talking about it is in terms of radiative transfer. And here we have the temperature at the top of the atmosphere. Here's the temperature at the bottom of the atmosphere. And this parameter tau is the optical depth. That's the ratio of the physical distance divided by how far light travels before it's absorbed, the mean free path of light. So if we make the atmosphere more opaque, the mean free path gets smaller. The same physical distance corresponds to a larger optical depth, and the temperature at the bottom of the atmosphere is going to be correspondingly bigger. So no matter how you figure it, the thicker the blanket, the hotter it's going to be under the blanket for a given heat flow. And we also talked about things like nuclear winter, where we cut off the heat flow by having 100% cloud cover so that there's no heat on the surface of the Earth, in which case the Earth would cool to the temperature of the clouds, and that would be cold. questions about remembering meteorology. Okay, so what are kind of the bare facts? So for all intents and purposes, Mercury and the moon have no atmosphere. There's a small amount of material that's around Mercury, but I'm not going to call it an atmosphere. It has no important effect that I know of. So mostly we're going to be talking then about Mars and Venus. And of course, in comparison to the Earth. So close enough for us, these atmospheres are both about 96% carbon dioxide and about 3% nitrogen. And we compare that, of course, to the Earth, where we've got, 71%, I think it's more like 78% nitrogen, and maybe 21% oxygen and 1% argon. Argon is incidentally the missing ingredient in those atmospheres too. So what's the difference and why? Well, the big and most obvious difference is these guys are mostly carbon dioxide. So why do they have so much more carbon dioxide than the Earth has? Well, it's really the opposite question. What happened to the Earth's carbon dioxide? We think that the Earth's atmosphere started out with lots of carbon dioxide. It's necessary to have a huge greenhouse effect early in the Earth's history in order to keep the planet from freezing over with a noticeably less luminous sun early in its history. So what happened to our carbon dioxide? Well, we've got a whole lot of CO stuff in the form of limestone. So we have so-called carbonate rocks that hold much more carbon dioxide than the current concentration of the Earth's atmosphere. So we think that what happened to lots of the Earth's carbon dioxide is it got dissolved in the oceans and then deposited as limestone under the oceans to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide. And we know the story about the oxygen, right? This is a product of life. You kill all the life on the planet, oxygen's a reactive gas, it would very quickly end up, well, very quickly, over millions of years, it would end up as rock. So what we'd be left with then would be an atmosphere that would be, if we put the limestone back in the air, we'd be left with an atmosphere that is carbon dioxide and nitrogen. So the differences we see are not at all surprising in terms of the overall composition of those guys. Now, if we go down the list of common constituents of the Earth's atmosphere, we've got nitrogen, oxygen, argon, and maybe the next thing you would talk about would be water. Water is highly variable, of course, it depends on the temperature. And it turns out that both of these atmospheres are dry. And we're going to want to try and figure out what happened to the water of these atmospheres. The story is kind of long, and we think let me back up one more step, I guess, and talk about what would happen to water currently on Mars. So you remember we looked at this state diagram, which says if you tell me the pressure and the temperature, I can tell you whether water is going to be in the form of a gas or a liquid or a solid or any of these other crystalline forms. So currently the atmosphere of Earth is about like there, a tenth of a megapascal. And so we have states that are solid ice, that are liquid, with the water boiling at short of 400 degrees Kelvin, right? 373 degrees Kelvin. And at higher temperatures, we have vapor. But the Martian atmosphere, it turns out, is roughly speaking a hundredth as dense as the Earth's atmosphere is. It's actually less than a hundredth of the density of Earth. So the corresponding pressure is down here. So we can't have liquid water on the surface of Mars today. Mars, if you put liquid water on the surface of Mars, it would either end up as solid or would end up as vapor. So water is like dry ice is on Earth, right? So dry ice goes directly from solid carbon dioxide to vaporous carbon dioxide without ever going through a liquid form. And at these low pressures, that's exactly how ice is on Mars. So, I know, that begs a whole other question. How can we have all of these flow features in sedimentary rocks that we have on Mars? Well, it must be that in the past, Mars had a much thicker atmosphere. It doesn't have to be hugely thicker. Maybe, well, I know it's your definition of huge. It would be nice if it were about 10 times thicker than it is now, so that we would have some limited range where we could have some liquid water. Incidentally, there are some, the deepest parts of the Martian atmosphere are probably just over the triple point of water. So it probably isn't exactly correct to say that you can't have liquid water any place on the surface. In the deepest craters of Mars, you can maybe have liquid water for a very small range of temperatures. But it's typically too cold anyway to have liquid water. Okay, so I'm not limiting myself just to liquid or solid water. Remember, Mars also has these so-called ice caps. But there isn't a lot of water in those ice caps compared to the amount of water we've got. So no matter how you figure it, we have a deficit of water on these terrestrial planets, and the expectation is actually kind of the reverse. If you think about how the solar system formed, the hotter you get, the closer you get to the furnace, the less you're going to have of the volatile substances. So we're thinking that the further you get out from the sun, water should be more and more common, not less and less common. So other things being equal, you would think that Mars would have more water than the Earth, but doesn't seem to be the case. So how can we get rid of water? Well, boiling it, of course, doesn't get rid of it, right? All it does is change it into another form. It's still water. So the fact, as it turns out, that Venus is so hot that you couldn't have liquid water on its surface doesn't explain what happened to the water. Right? All that would do is give us gaseous water, and there isn't much gaseous water on Venus. So we have to do more than that. We have to either assume that Venus was formed under different conditions, and we don't really think that. So our best guess is that Venus started out with pretty much the same amount of water that the Earth did, maybe a little bit less because it was closer to the sun, but it's not that much closer to the sun. So somehow or other, we have to totally get rid of the water. But Venus, when we've talked about escapes before, it was based on temperature and the mass of the molecule, right? We were comparing the thermal velocity and the thermal velocity depended on the temperature and the mass of the object. And water is water. It has the same mass on Venus as it has on Earth on a per atom basis. And the temperature is a lot hotter, so we have a higher thermal velocity. And we have the escape velocity, Venus and the Earth have very similar masses, similar sizes, they have similar escape velocities. And the temperature just isn't enough to do it. And I guess what I need to flash is this transparency. What happens if we look at the vertical structure of the atmospheres of these planets? I don't know if I like that one better than this one. Okay, so here's again the Earth surface temperature, kind of typically 300 Kelvin. You go up, it gets colder. You go up higher, it gets hotter. All of the usual stuff. So how is that different on Venus? So the main difference is this spot where we have the so-called tropopause, the difference between where we have it getting hotter with altitude and when it getting colder with altitude is 60, 100 kilometers up high. And as you go down, it's 10 degrees per kilometer. So it's a lot more kilometers, so it's a lot hotter on the surface of Venus than it is on the Earth. Simply a thicker blanket is responsible for these very high temperatures, hotter than the inside of Europe, and comparable to the melting point of lead on the surface of the planet of Venus. But where is the water? Well, we know the water isn't here. It's too hot. The water that we see on Venus is actually in clouds that are about at this altitude. And those temperatures aren't that different from the temperatures of the Earth. So temperature isn't going to be able to explain the absence of water on the planet. Well, what was the explanation for the stratosphere? So that was the ozone layer that was absorbing the sun's ultraviolet light. And of course, the ozone came from the oxygen. Typically, UV light is able to rearrange molecules, cause molecules to break apart. That's why it's a good cancer-causing agent. So here we had the ozone layer that was protecting us, but it's also protecting our water, because the water is never going to get above the ozone layer simply because it's too cold. Any water is going to condense out way low in the troposphere. So even though it's warm up here, it's warm enough to have a noticeable concentration of water, the water is never going to get up there because it's going to condense out as rain a few kilometers above the Earth's atmosphere. So our water is never exposed to ultraviolet light. So the molecules of water remain molecules of water. Not going to happen for Venus. Venus doesn't have oxygen, therefore doesn't have an ozone layer, therefore doesn't have this extra inversion. It just has basically a troposphere and a thermosphere. And water will make it up to these altitudes where it can be broken apart by ultraviolet light. And then we have what? Hydrogen and oxygen. Hydrogen is a low mass molecule. It can escape just fine. What happens to the oxygen? Well, the same thing that would happen to the oxygen on Earth. It's going to end up in rocks. It's a highly reactive gas. So what happened, we think, to Venus's water is that, first of all, it got hot, so it evaporated. No ozone layer to protect it from ultraviolet light. Once it was up at altitude, it could be broken apart. One piece escaped the hydrogen. The other piece ended up in rock, and all of the H2O is gone. Okay, it's a story. Some evidence to support this story is, you remember, hydrogen comes in two forms. It comes in the form of so-called heavy hydrogen, deuterium, and normal hydrogen. And it turns out that the ratio of deuterium oxide to water oxide is very much enriched on Venus compared to what it is on Earth. Presumably because deuterium is, you know, almost twice as hard to escape as hydrogen is. So Venus has presumably hung on to a good amount of its deuterium, but the normal hydrogen, which is 99% of the hydrogen, was subject to escape. Okay, so high temperatures because of thick atmosphere, 10 degrees per kilometer for 50 kilometers, is going to add up to 500 degrees Celsius. And that's the extra boost in temperature we have for Venus. How about for Mars? Well, for Mars, it's a smaller planet, so direct escape is possible. And it turns out, again, no ozone, so we're going to have UV light being able to break it apart. But overall, Mars is so cold that we really don't expect much water in the atmosphere, period. So maybe there wasn't all that much escape, except maybe in this earlier, warmer period. It may well be that Mars still has lots of water, but not in the ice caps and not in the atmosphere, but maybe basically in the soil. So there might be ice that is mixed in with the rock for several kilometers down. Of course, we don't know. But currently, Mars's atmosphere doesn't have much water simply because it's cold, and the ice caps aren't nearly enough to make up for the missing water. Okay, so the composition, first approximation, should come as no surprise. Carbon dioxide and nitrogen are very natural things to have in your atmosphere. They're both very stable molecules. And you remember that in the big scale, after hydrogen and helium, What comes next in terms of concentration are things like carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. So it's a very natural thing to have as your atmosphere. And presumably the Earth had the same thing, but the Earth's carbon dioxide has ended up in rock. Questions? Well, while we're here, let's take a look at the vertical structure in Mars's atmosphere. And so, roughly speaking, Venus's atmosphere is 100 times what our atmosphere is. So the total pressure, which remember is the weight of the atmosphere, the total pressure on Venus is roughly speaking 100 times the Earth's pressure. So it corresponds to the pressure about a kilometer down in the ocean. So we think of air as being hardly noticeable, but on Venus, air has a density that's about 5% of water. So there's a noticeable pushback from gas that is that high density. Roughly speaking, Mars has a density that is about 1/100th of the atmosphere of the Earth. So, you know, it would be vacuum by normal sorts of standards, but there is something there. And what we see here is that there is a troposphere where as you go closer to the furnace that is the heated rock of the surface of the planet, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. The adiabatic lapse rate depends on the acceleration of gravity, and Mars is a smaller planet, it has a smaller acceleration of gravity. And it turns out this adiabatic lapse rate that we have for Mars is about 4 degrees Celsius per kilometer. So that by itself is going to automatically mean that other things being equal, we're not going to have as big a greenhouse effect on Mars as we have on the Earth. Okay, so not much really there. Roughly speaking, we've got a troposphere and a thermosphere. No stratosphere division because, again, no oxygen, so there's no ozone to cause that thermal inversion. The other line that's there has to do with a phenomenon on Mars that happens pretty much every year, and that's global dust storms. So the winds on Mars are significant enough that they can raise dust storms, and particularly absent the water, the fine dust is able to be suspended in the atmosphere for a long period of time. And what happens under these conditions is kind of twofold. So first of all, if we have an atmosphere that's more opaque, it's going to heat the upper part of the atmosphere. So you can see the upper atmosphere is going to be hotter than it would be normally. This graph actually shows the surface temperature warmer, but it's actually cooler, typically, on average, in the dusty atmosphere than it is normally. And you can see what is for sure the case is the slope of this line, the adiabatic lapse rate, is a lot more severe for the dusty atmosphere than the adiabatic atmosphere. And that's because it's not convective. So this is kind of a near nuclear winter sort of situation, where we're cutting off the source of light at the surface of the planet because of all of this dust. Well, why don't we have something like nuclear winter on Venus, right? Because maybe I didn't tell you, but I think I've mentioned it a few times. Venus has 100% cloud cover. So there are these huge range of clouds. They're typically not water. They're typically sulfuric acid, which has water and sulfur dioxide mixed into it, roughly speaking at about 50 kilometers altitude. So this picture is showing an active volcano. And remember I said maybe to the active volcano. I think I might believe the active volcano. So are these clouds significant enough so that no light gets through? We can't see through those clouds, but you can have stuff like the glass that's often in bathrooms that allows light to go through, but you can't see through them, kind of translucent glass. So what's the situation on the surface of the planet? Is it dark or is it bright? And we've landed probes, so we know what you can see on the surface. What you see is not as bright as full sunlight, not as bright as you would see if you just had an open view to the north, so no direct sunlight, but just kind of the blue light that you would get. It's not that bright. It's a little bit dimmer than that, not as dim as twilight is here on Earth, but dim light is making it through the surface of these clouds. So the surface is being heated by the sun, and what we're seeing then is the temperature difference that's required for that energy to work its way through this very thick blanket. Okay, so not quite opaque enough to kill all of the sunlight on the surface of the planet. So not quite opaque enough to cause a nuclear winter sort of effect. Notice if it did, it wouldn't be so bad from our sorts of considerations. You remember that in nuclear winter, what happens is the surface of the planet reaches the temperature of what's heating it, which is now the cloud layer. So under those circumstances, the temperature at the surface of Venus would be comparable to the temperatures of the surface of the Earth, right? So 300 Kelvin is basically room temperature. Incidentally, this diagram has a stratosphere, so I don't like it. There isn't any standard stratosphere in any planet except the Earth, right? Because the Earth is the only one that has oxygen. It's the only one that has the inversion, the change in temperature, that I would say is required for an atmosphere. So we go from troposphere to, I would say, thermosphere for all of the atmospheres, including the giant planet atmospheres. Okay, so much for kind of the average content of the atmospheres of these planets. How about the dynamics? What's the weather like on these planets? Weather or climate? So Venus is, of course, a slow rotator. And so that means the Coriolis force is going to be negligibly small. So that means we can't have the sort of high and low pressure systems that we have on Earth. We can't have this geostrophic balance, wherever I wrote that word, can't have geostrophic balance. But we're going to have some sort of steady state situation, right? By definition, what you observe is going to be an equilibrium situation. And what we have is called cyclotropic motion. And it's a balance not between the Coriolis force, but between that swear word, the centrifugal force, and the pressure force. So that leads to a radically different sort of atmosphere. Instead of having these high and low pressure systems, which are blowing in different directions in the north and southern hemisphere, it turns out that what Venus has is an equatorial superrotating jet. Okay, so what do these words mean? So we're talking about a jet like our jet stream, so I'm not talking about the winds on the surface of Venus. So again, the Russians have landed probes on the surface of Venus. We've crash landed things onto Venus. The Russians have soft landed things on Venus and that have survived for a few hours, and we know that the surface winds are small. So we're not talking about surface winds here. We're talking about winds at altitude, 50 kilometers or so above the surface. Super rotating. Well, I think as much as anything else, this is supposed to help us remember the direction. So what super rotating is meaning is that the winds are blowing in the same way the planet is rotating, which is backwards. But faster. Okay? And of course, this is just saying where these winds are located. So if we have kind of a picture of Venus, remember it's rotating backwards, so I would like to say its northern hemisphere is in the south, but I can't say that and be accurate. So there are winds that are blowing in the same way the planet is rotating, but faster than the planet is rotating. Right? These planets are these winds are orbiting the planet in about 4 days, four of our days, on the order of 100 meters a second winds at altitude. And again, the cause of this is basically the same cause for all dynamics. It's convection, that is to say, unequal heating. So the equator is going to be heated more than the poles are going to be heated, and we're going to have some sort of process that is going to transport heat from the equator to the poles. Now, the Earth's convection between the equators and the poles is broken up into a series of Hadley cells basically because of the rotation of the planet. The faster the rotation of the planet, the more we're going to see these Hadley cells break up into subgroups. And we can duplicate that in our labs. So Venus is basically not rotating, very slow backward rotating. So what we have is a big convection cell that's going from nearly the poles to the equator. And with this very thick atmosphere, even though Venus is a very slow rotator, so you're going to have very long nights, the blanket is very thick. So there's very little difference between the surface temperature on the dark side of the planet and the surface temperature on the front side of the planet. So on Earth, we have a fairly thick blanket, so it can get below freezing like it did overnight, but there aren't huge changes in temperature. And of course, contrary-wise for Mars, Mars has a very thin blanket. There are huge differences in temperatures between the daytime temperature and the nighttime temperature. It has a spin rate very similar to the Earth's, however. Okay, so Venus has a very different circulation, and it has, incidentally, this it's called a polar vortex on both the North and the South Pole. I'll show you pictures of this later. And it's actually So polar here is saying the location. It's in the North and the South Pole. The actual vortex typically has two kind of funnels in it. So sometimes it's called a dipole polar vortex, but I won't use that word because polar there is meaning two different things in the two very closely adjacent words. So we got polar vortices in the north and south hemisphere. So in your book, you will see pictures of Venus that have kind of cloud-shaped features that have kind of a Y shape. And I've also told you that Venus has 100% cloud cover. There are no surface features that you can see. So what's going on here? Well, the pictures that show these features in the atmosphere of Venus, they're taken in ultraviolet light. So if you look with your eye, you just see a uniform white glob. There's nothing to be seen for Venus. So only in ultraviolet light do you see these cloud features. And from those cloud features, you can see how long it takes the clouds to move, and that's how we get a handle on these winds. So we have, the U.S. has sent three probes to the atmosphere of Venus, so we do have the sort of data that went into these plots of the range of pressure and temperature as these probes parachuted through the atmosphere of Venus. And did hit the surface and did, they weren't designed to survive for any period of time on the surface. Okay. So very little day-to-night variation, very high speed winds at altitude, but not on the surface, and these extremely high temperatures that are caused by the very thick blanket. So how about Mars? So in Venus, we kind of see the Earth meteorology modified by having cloud cover, slow rotation, and a lot thicker atmosphere. In Mars, we see kind of the reverse. So if you've ever seen pictures of Mars, it's usually cloud-free. Right? So in Universal Picture, I think heading for movies, they show this beautiful globed Earth with 100% oceans that you can see, right? That's what they maybe thought in the 20s when that company started. But the Earth always has lots of clouds. And Venus always has 100% clouds. And Mars usually has no clouds. And kind of no surprise, the temperatures are cold enough that you wouldn't expect water to make it up high in the atmosphere. But actually, there are, on occasions, both carbon dioxide and water clouds, but they're pretty rare. If we see stuff in the atmosphere, usually it's dust. So dust is what can make the atmosphere opaque. And those storms happen episodically. So typically, if you look at a picture of Mars, you can see pole to pole with no clouds. We'll see contrary cases in a second. So the one thing that's very different between Mars and the Earth has to do with kind of the seasonal effect. So you all know, I hope, that the cause of the Earth's seasons has nothing to do with the fact that we're sometimes closer to the Earth, sun and sometimes farther away from the sun. And the evidence for that, of course, is that we're actually closest to the sun when we have winter in Minnesota as opposed to winter in Australia. But it's a pretty small effect for the Earth because the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit is just a few percent. So you remember, leaving aside Mercury and Pluto, Mars has the next biggest eccentricity, an eccentricity of about a tenth. So as a result, there is a very noticeable difference between Mars when it's close to the sun, perihelion, and when it's far from the sun. And the way it works is the same way it works on Earth. That is to say, when we have winter in the northern hemisphere, that's when Mars is close to the sun, and when we have summer in the northern hemisphere, that's when we're going to be far from the sun. So seasons are moderated a little bit in the northern hemisphere because of that effect. When it would be hot, it's far, so it's kind of cold. When it would be cold, it's closer, so it would be hotter than normal. And of course, it's contrary-wise in the southern hemisphere. So the southern hemisphere is going to have the hottest summers, and it's going to have the coolest winters because of this sort of effect. So there's a big difference between the seasons in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. So how does that all affect the climate, the weather on Mars? So it turns out that at the equinoxes, right? So equinoxes are springs and falls. At the equinoxes, things are kind of similar to the way they are on Earth, right? We've got the kind of symmetrical Hadley cell around the equator. We've got two westward going jets in the two hemispheres, and we've got the stronger sort of jet here in the fall hemisphere. But in midwinter, when we have solstices, then it turns out that the Hadley cell really spans the equator. And we have a very strong westward wind jet, kind of unfortunate reversal, right? So we name winds for where they came from, not where they're going. So this W jet is blowing from the west to the east. And it's particularly strong in the winter hemisphere, just as it is particularly strong in our winter hemisphere. But now we have this Hadley cell that actually spans the equator, connecting up more the southern hemisphere and the northern hemisphere. And actually, there's a weaker backwards jet in the summer hemisphere for Mars. Okay, but to some extent, all of these things are a pretty small change because there's only a hundredth as much atmosphere on Mars as there is on Earth to begin with. But there still is enough atmosphere to have occasional clouds and to still have high and low pressure systems. So we have pictures of clouds circulating around the same way they do on Earth, depending upon which hemisphere you're in for the low and high pressure systems. And we'll see in a minute things that sure look like tornadoes. They're usually called dust devils that punctuate the surface of Mars. Questions? Okay, so let's take a look at some pictures of these phenomena. Maybe not. You hear it starting up? There it is. I think the other ones will be okay, but this one's... They're to cool us now. Okay, so Venus, you remember, it has this super rotating wind that makes this Y pattern. I guess I didn't bother to get any pictures of that because it's more interested in these polar vortices. So you can see that it's kind of a double vortex. We got one there and one there. And we've got winds that are, you know, blowing around it just like water going down a drain, although it's not Coriolis balanced. It's centrifugal force balanced. And these are, again, pictures not in visible light. If you looked in visible light, just be nice white. Okay, so these are wispy clouds that were taken from one of the rovers on the surface of Mars. So mostly, I mean, this is more a rare occurrence than a common occurrence. Mostly you're going to see beautiful pink skies on Mars. Pink because the dust that's in the atmosphere. But there are clouds that you can see have been photographed, and from these we can get some idea of what the winds are at altitude. So this is a recent movie of something that they call dust devils, but they are like 10 kilometers high, so it's kind of a super dust devil. This played earlier, so I'm hoping it's going to play again. So this is not a simulation. This is a real photograph from a spacecraft that's going by. So for the rovers, it turns out that what happens is the solar panels kind of collect dust over time, and so they lose their efficiency. But occasionally one of these dust devils goes over and it cleans off the dust. So they've actually been able to operate longer than you would think. So you can see a planet that is has a whole lot of these dunes and not bare bedrock the way we think that, the way all the surface pictures that we have, namely from these Russian probes, look like for Venus. And I think there's a still of the same thing here. Same sort of story. Questions about atmospheres? Okay, so the plan next time is to go on and take a look at the giant planets. And the story is, I hope, going to come as no great surprise. So the giant planets are, generally speaking, spinning faster and, of course, have no solid surface. So the most obvious feature that we're going to have, if I can find it, are Hadley cells, multiple Hadley cells, which go under the name of zones and belts. I still got a couple of seconds to try and find it. Well, I got this one, but I don't want to show you that one. Here we go. So you remember that for us at the equator, we have a region of uplift, which we would call a zone, and then at kind of 30 degrees latitudes, we have downdraft, which in Jupiter's atmosphere would be called a belt. So for Jupiter, we see these stripes where we have these general properties, and these are things that we never got a good look at Jupiter at the observatory, but you can make them out at the observatory in the pictures from the planet, from the spacecraft that have gone by. You can see in great detail this sort of phenomena. And what we're going to have is zonal winds that go this way and that reverse as we go through these high and low pressure systems. And that's, of course, because we're going to have this region of uplift is going to be correspondingly warmer, so we're going to have the pressure decreasing less with altitude, so we're going to have overall a high pressure system here and a low pressure system there. So we're going to have the same old jet stream sort of phenomena, except jet stream phenomena that is reversed multiple times as we go towards the poles. All right, so we just have one jet stream and we have three Hadley cells. We're going to see much more than that going on, particularly in the atmosphere of Jupiter, which, it, as the biggest planet, kind of has the biggest effect of the Coriolis force. And we see the same thing, but maybe not quite so clear, for the other gas giant planets. Okay, so with that preview, we'll call it quits.